Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
But anyway, speaking of the extraordinary, we have got a fascinating guest today. I've been looking so forward to speaking with this guest. We have got Julie, get this. We've got Linda Godfrey. Now, she's an author. She's written over 17 books on strange creatures, phenomena, and people.
And I don't know how anyone has the time to write that amount of books, let alone have all the kind of the knowledge to put into that. It's just outstanding.
My God, and she covers the whole gambit. I mean, creatures, phenomena, people. And plus, in between writing all these books, she has the time to be frequent guest on national TV and radio shows, such as Monster Quest, Fox News, Red Eye, Lost Tapes, Monsters and Mysteries, Sean Hannity's America. I mean, it goes on and on.
Well, I think Linda has, we all need a little bit of it, because she's outstanding.
Where do you come up with the energy? Welcome, Linda.
Hello, thanks so much for having me. And if you're asking me where I come up with the energy, well, a lot of days I don't. I think I just have a passion and enthusiasm for all of these subjects. And, you know, it helps keep me going on the days when I'm not quite feeling so great. But I wrote, 12 years ago, I wrote two books while undergoing pretty heavy-duty treatment for breast cancer. And I just am coming up on my 12th cancerversary free, and broke up with my cancer doctor yesterday, which was really nice. They say breakups aren't good, but if it's your oncologist, then it's a good thing. So I always thought, well, if I got through that and could still write, you know, the other days that I have now are usually not so bad. So it's just a matter of what you have to compare it to, I guess.
Well, congratulations for yesterday, Linda. That's a huge milestone, isn't it, 12 years?
Thank you, yeah. Yeah, he said, 12 years? I don't think it's coming back. And I'm like, I'll take your word for it, Doc. You know, it sounds good to me.
Cancer-free. Thank God. Again, let me amend what Julie just said. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. I give all the credit to God and to my wonderful doctor and surgeons and tech people. And even the chemist that came up with kind of a last-ditch Hail Mary treatment that actually fit my cancer type perfectly and was probably what helped keep it from coming back. because he didn't think I was going to last the year. I didn't tell people that at the time, but that was his initial opinion. So, hallelujah.
My good, you know, I can't imagine, you know, everybody gives a different take on it. But what was your take when a doctor sits you down and says, listen, Linda, you're not going to last out the year. What is that impact on you personally?
My first thought was, that's what you think. I'm sort of feisty that way. You know, and I just had a real strong faith in God. I still do. And I know that my times are determined by his hand and not by my own, no matter how it looks to us on this earth. You know, he sees the other side. And I also did, I just researched the heck out of it, and I did a lot of herbal things and meditations and, you know, all sorts of alternative treatments that I could manage. And I was very good about my diet and other things, you know, so I did everything on the physical end too. And then, thank goodness, they came out with the particular medicine that helps what I had. And I had an extra year of injections of that and seemed to do the trick.
Wow.
Now, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I'll tell you real quickly. You know, people look at me and they think, well, does this have anything to do with, like, what you're researching? And I can tell you a kind of a funny story that it's not too long. I don't know if you've ever heard of the man bat. It's very similar to bat squatch, which is, you know, one of the best two names for cryptids that I've ever heard of. Well, I had a call from a man on the western side of Wisconsin who said he had seen this. It looked like a giant bat with wings spread as wider than his pickup truck, and this large man-sized furry creature inside of it. It almost hit his pickup truck. Him and his son were in it. And just before they thought it was going to smash their windshield, it went screaming up into the sky, just took off straight up, and both of them immediately became very sick. Well, it was about that time that I had put off for way too long my annual exam, and I'd gone in to see the doctor and found out that I did indeed have this this kind of stealth tumor growing. And was hiding out behind a benign tumor. And they showed it to me. And on the x-ray, I swear, the second tumor that was behind the first one looked exactly like a classic UFO dish. That's exactly how it was configured. And my doctor said, you know, he said, this form that you have is so fast growing that I think it was 3 weeks ago. He said three weeks ago or something like that. It didn't exist. If you hadn't come in exactly when you did, it wouldn't have been there yet, and we would have missed it. So the final kicker was that I'm thinking in my mind, that many weeks ago, where was I? And I realized that was the weekend I was doing the field research on the man bat, really only a few days after it had been there. And we were going to all the sites and spending, I'm with the witness, we're out literally in the field where they saw it come from, and looking at remains of a deer that were there, you know, putting myself in all these places that might have, you know, according to some theory that I think holds a lot of water, some sort of different electromagnetic field or charge as a result of these kind of netherworld entities, you know, where they show up. And many people in this field do seem to die prematurely of cancer and other strange diseases. So, you know, I don't say that, yeah, that's what caused it, but I do say, it seems mighty suspicious.
You know, it does, and there's a lot of theories with that we'll get into here in a few moments. But you say that, you know, when you were given the news that you had cancer, it kind of opened up time to begin your writing. But what got you interested in cryptos, you know, cryptids or cryptozoology to begin with?
Well, it was being a newspaper reporter, and actually by the time I had the cancer, that was 2000. What would that have been? Well, anyway, I had already written several books. I had written The Beast of Bray Road, my first book, The Poison Widow, A True Story of Sins, Strychnine, and Murder, and the Weird Wisconsin and Weird Michigan books, and I was working on the follow-up books to those particular ones, and Hunting the American Werewolf. So I think I was like 5 or 6 books into the book phase of it. But it started back in 1991-92 when I was a new reporter for the Walworth County newspaper in southern Wisconsin. And it just happened to fall to me to write the story about this creature that people out on Bray Road, which is a maybe 3 to 4 mile long country road just outside of Elkhorn, my hometown, and they were saying that they had seen this thing that looked like a werewolf because it was wolf-headed, had tall ears on top of its head, a long snout, a tail, furry, flowing hair, all of those things, but it ran and walked easily on its hind legs and would chase cars on its hind legs and jump onto cornfields or be walking across the road. And not only that, I discovered that our county animal control officer had been receiving reports on it. And that's what first, because at first I thought it was ridiculous and I laughed. And then I thought, well, if you're going to, you know, perpetrate a hoax on the public, do you really go call a public official and give them all your contact information so they can come back and find you and charge you with fraud or whatever they want to? So that made me think they were probably saying something. I didn't know what. And when I went to interview them, you know, there were a select number that agreed to be interviewed for the paper, I realized they weren't, you know, just one type of person. There were men, women, older, young, farmers, blue collar, white collar. It was a diverse mix of people that I couldn't imagine them all getting together and plotting, you know, to rent some cheesy werewolf suit and jump out in the road at people. So I wrote it up just really with the facts as they described them. And I know my editor and I thought it would amuse local people for a little while and then go away. And then, lo and behold, 2 weeks later, it had gone not only national but international. And we had TV crews from not just the local Madison, Milwaukee stations, but also Inside Edition came out, and an early In Search of, Sci-Fi In Search Of show, mm-hmm. Things like that. I was on radio shows just, you know, all over the country. There was a period of about 2 weeks where I just couldn't even take a bath. You know, it was without the phone ringing. It was just crazy. And then we were getting busloads of tourists from Chicago coming up, and the local merchants were doing things like the bars had a silver bullet special. The newspaper was putting out T-shirts. The bakery was putting out werewolf cookies. And, you know, I'm just looking at all of this and thinking, oh, my goodness, you know, it's a phenomenon. And I realized that even if it turned out to be nothing or a hoax or something like that, at the very least, I was witnessing the beginning of a legend. I could see that. You know, I knew people would be talking about this around campfires for a long time. And I felt like that I was beholden to become what I called the keeper of the lore. So people were sending me all kinds of reports during the next 10 years during which I worked for the newspaper, doing all kinds of other stories, you know, all the mundane, you know, school problems and people features and that kind of thing, and just doing little updates once in a while. And finally, somewhere around 2000, I thought, well, if I'm ever going to write about a book about it, I should do it now, because people's interest had never waned, and I was getting more and more inquiries. And I thought, I'll just write one book. It'll answer all the questions, tell how the whole thing went. And I wrote The Beast of Bray Road, and I had no trouble selling it to a regional publisher. And lo and behold, when that came out, it just started things all up again. I got more and more reports, and that necessitated writing my second book on it, Hunting the American Werewolf, which, by the way, Monster Quest, you mentioned earlier, Monster Quest was a really good show, and they have a lot of episodes that are still being watched a lot. And the first season end of the show finale was based on that book, Hunting the American Werewolf. It's just called The American Werewolf, A Monster Quest. But all that got things going again. So then, you know, the book started. Every time I would have a book published, I would just get more on it. And it's just 26 years later, here I am.
So prior to you writing kind of your first book about this very strange creature, how far back had sightings gone?
Well, in that particular area, I had them going back to the early 80s, I think 1981. There was another sort of ambiguous sighting in an adjoining county, Jefferson County, which wasn't real. It's probably about a good 40-minute drive to Bray Road from there. So it's not right next to it or anything. But this is one of the most interesting sightings that people still ask about. It's called, some people call it the Gadara episode, because it involved this creature that was seen in 1936 digging in an ancient Native American burial mound on the grounds of a large Catholic institution, which was one where they cared for people with special needs of different types. And John Kennedy's sister was one of those who was cared for there, as a matter of fact. Well, they had a night watchman, a very devout man, a former boxer, kind of a big man. He's walking around doing his midnight rounds on the grounds itself. He's not driving. He's walking with a big kind of a billy stick flashlight, and he sees this thing digging in one of the mounds, and it looked up at him, and he looked at it. It stood up. That's when the man got really kind of excited, and before he knew it, the creature turned around and kind of melted into the darkness. Well, the next night, he went to the same burial mound again, and the creature was there once more, and this time it stood up, kind of faced off with him, and uttered something that the man thought sounded like the word Gadara. It was kind of a growly. Now, I always put on my reporter's hat and say, although those are the sounds you would hear from a growl, like, grrr, you know, kind of like that. But to him, the man, it sounded like Gadara, which is a region in the Holy Lands where, right where Jesus was able to cast the demons out of a man. They entered a herd of swine and went into the water, and that is the region of Gadara, and the man was called a Gadarene because of it. So that really lent an extra kind of spooky resonance to it. And then I had heard rumors that there were exorcisms and things like that. It took me 6 years to get to talk to the correct nun who would tell me about the story, and it turns out that somewhere around that time, and this is a very, you know, kind of lonely little country church. The church was across the road from the institute and still is there. But there was a young person who became, I guess you would call it possessed. They believed that he had an evil demon in him, and this church had the priest, and I think some helper priests too, to perform an exorcism on him. And supposedly it was successful, but then whatever he cast out started following the priest. And the priest actually had to leave the parish and go away to another state for a little time. He eventually came back. But whatever it was doing things like, just like in Poltergeist, you know, pulling the blankets down off the bed, and he'd hear words, and it was really kind of terrible. And so all of that was tied up into this Gadara Mound 1936 sighting by this man who, again, was a very devout Catholic. The only way I knew about it is that his son, who was a newspaper editor, one of the nicest, again, very, very devout people that I've ever known, very strong Catholic, he called to tell me when he saw it in the paper, he called to tell me what his father had seen, and there was a drawing that his dad had made, had actually directed his son to make for him while the dad was on his deathbed. And it shows kind of a hybrid, it looks sort of like half Bigfoot and half canine. And really, nobody who sees these creatures reports something like that. It's usually, if they get a good look, they know that it's either a canine, big, like upright wolf, or a primate, Bigfoot type of thing. So it's an interesting aspect.
So what do you think? I mean, we've talked so far about three different types of cryptids. What do you think the beginning origin? Are these something new, or are these creatures something that has been around since time immemorial and we're just now discovering them? And if that's true, why are they suddenly choosing now to begin, you know, being seen?
Well, if you go back to our earliest known civilizations, you know, and we look at their pictographs and their writings and things, you can see creatures like these depicted, you know, on temple walls, on pottery, in jewelry, which tells us they at least, whether or not they were actually having encounters with them, they at least had the concept. The one that always comes first to mind is Egypt, of course, where you see like Anubis, the jackal-headed dog, which was the one of the overseers of their underworld. And I have people report jet black, smooth furred, upright canines with very, very tall, pointy ears, you know, that say remind them almost exactly of Anubis. And there it was being seen. There were other types of dog or wolf slash human things too. You go back to Mesopotamia and some of the religions there, some of the earliest writings, the Epic of Gilgamesh, you have this forest inhabiting creature named Enkidu, who is really more like part human and covered with fur and hair. It's very much, people point to that and think of Bigfoot, you know, an early version of it anyway. And the hair, the huge hair-covered human is just an archetype. These things go way back in civilization. So I think it would be wrong to say they're a brand new thing. But perhaps, you know, there are a couple of different possibilities. One is that our population has grown so much that these things used to be able just to hide out and almost never be seen by humans unless they chose to. And now we've been cutting down the forests and building cities and you know, they're burning down the jungles in the Amazon. All of these wonderful habitats are going, and so these things are more exposed. Some people think it's because they are coming from another realm, another dimension, and that there are portals, and that this is the time prophesied in many religions where the veil is growing thin between the worlds, and these things are coming through and preparing for whatever end time business is going to go on. You know, you think even of the Scandinavians and their Ragnarok, which predicts the cyclic end of one world and beginning of another. And then you see them also depicted in Southern American mystery temples. So they're very old things, whatever they are. And even the Native Americans, you know, I've asked whenever I get a chance, I have some friends, and I've been honored to be able to get an interview with a Ho-Chunk anthropologist and elder. And what most of them say, and of course, this is by no means one monolithic, completely the same thing, because you will find some other first people that have a little different look at it. But most of the ones that I talk to say, these creatures have been here before people were here. They come from the spirit world, which, you know, you might rename another dimension or something like that. And they believe their portals are in fresh springs of water, that they come here, and when they're here, they can be completely corporeal. They make footprints, they have weight, they eat, they sleep, they have babies, but they can also be somewhere on a sliding scale between our reality and that other reality, much as the same way sound is on a sliding scale from dog whistle high down to very low infrasound.
Yes.
You know, it's that kind of a thing. If you know how the universe is structured, it makes sense. So that explains why sometimes they're seen, you know, as as being transparent, or, you know, the footsteps just stop in the middle of a snowfield, that kind of thing. And this seems to be what most of them agree on. And I have to say, you know, taking out all bias, it is the plan or the story that explains best everything that's reported, everything that people have observed about all these types of creatures fit with that scenario better than any other explanation that I found.
Yeah, you're right. In preparation for this interview, I watched a show, Theories on Cryptids and Why They're So Rarely Seen.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And they said exactly what you just said, that these beings, you know, are possibly interdimensional, and they operate at certain frequencies. Kind of like, why do we see ghosts out of the corner of our eyes rather than straight on? Because the eye operates differently. Wavelengths are different. And they said that it's possible that they can manipulate radio waves.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Or that they can somehow manipulate the essence of our consciousness. And, you know, it's not the eye which decides what we see. The eye is merely the vehicle that takes in whatever light waves are there. And then the brain interprets them. So, you know, and that it's kind of hard to get a handle on thinking about that. But to give you an idea, somebody did an experiment where I'm thinking they had the people turned upside down for a great amount of time, so it looked like everything was upside, or they did something so it looked like everything was upside down to them. I think they had some special glasses created that they were wearing, so as they walked around, it looked like everything was upside down. And they found that after a few weeks, everybody's sense of where they were completely flipped over and changed, so that they again saw that they were going, you know, everything was right side up again. The only thing that changed was their own brainwave in how it interpreted what the eyes were taking in.
Oh, that would drive me nuts. But then again, yes. That's me after a six-pack of Pabst. But, you know, you're making absolute sense. And going back to a previous point, I wasn't suggesting that cryptids are anything new. You know, from my point of view, Because, well, let's go really cliche here. Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Yeti, Abominable Snowman. They're all basically the same creature, just different cultures that have experienced them for, you know, millennia.
Right.
But right. Suddenly it seems that, like you suggested, possibly it's due to deforestation. Suddenly it's like it's everywhere. Boom. You know, since the 60s and 70s, you know, of course, my favorite, you know, National Enquirer and Weekly World News, you know, you got the Bat Boy and, you know, I got Sasquatch's baby. You know,
yeah.
I mean, what is happening, you know?
You know, it's also bolstered by the fact that the known animals are doing the exact same thing. I've been studying cougars for several years, ever since my husband got stalked by one in our backyard in southeastern Wisconsin. He's very lucky he's alive today. He had to walk backwards across our entire acre of yard, yelling and kicking his feet, and it was nighttime, with this thing like 3 feet away from him growling the whole time. And so I've been paying particular attention, and it turns out they're all over the place. And it is being suppressed for some reason. I'm not sure why. But even the extent that they will admit it, you're finding articles in mainstream magazines like National Geographic and the Smithsonian telling about the eastward movement of the mountain lion that used to be considered, everybody thought we had confined it to the western states. And it's being found, there was one they managed to follow its DNA through droppings and things like that. And it was one that was out west and made it all the way up into Connecticut, the same animal. One that was here in southeastern Wisconsin was also followed the same way and was determined to be one that was shot in a residential neighborhood in Chicago. So the regular animals, wolves, are coming eastward. Coyotes are coming eastward and mating with wolves and creating this kind of unafraid super coyote. So we've got all this stuff happening with the known animals. And remember, these other ones, even if there's something strange or otherworldly about them, when they're here, they act like the real. They need food. They follow the same deer paths as the others. So I don't think it's surprising. And they do show up when you map them out. They show up heavier. The sightings are heavier in certain known travel corridors for all wildlife. These things are there, too. And maybe that's why they're found heavily around the Great Lakes. And then there are sort of spurs of migration that go down to southwestern United States, down into Texas. Another one goes southward to Georgia. You've got another one that turns and goes upright to New York State and Maine. And, it makes sense when you map things out like that. And you think if it was just people having airy-fairy moments where they're, imagining something or hallucinating something, they'd be all over the place. There wouldn't be any order to them at all. And that's not what you see when you really take time to look at them and map them out.
So I'm just thinking of the sheer volume of the books that you've written to date, Linda, and I'm just thinking about, certainly we can hear so much experience, but you must have done so much research. And while we're researching on maybe one topic or experiences that others have seen or accounted for, we come across other questions, and I'm sure that those other questions have then kind of pursued to book two, book three, book four. How have you managed to, I suppose, contain that information and structure it in your books going forward?
Well, I've had different ways. You know, in some books I've structured them geographically, and that actually is probably the highest form of interest for readers, because everybody wants to know what's in my backyard, what should I be looking for. So that's one good way. Another way is by the animals themselves. My American Monsters book, which is so far I think the best selling, the publisher tells me, has them by their own characteristics. So I've got three main sections of the book. The first is things that fly, and then I've got things that swim, and then things that go by land. And I was actually shocked how many different things I found that were unknown flying creatures, gigantic birds with 20 to 22 foot wingspans by impeccable, just impeccable witnesses, you know, that you can't put down. But and when you start looking, you find that there really have been lots of these that are just put off as jokes or not important or whatever, but they are there. And some you can explain with zoo animals. Others, you know, you just can't by any means. My latest book, Monsters Among Us, I put in general categories of their different weirdnesses. ones that glowed, ones that did this and that. But I also took the structuring a step further, just as an example, because you know, one book, no matter how thick it is not going to be a statistically reliable thing. But I thought, well, what if every time we had one of these, when we know the date, when we know the geographical location, don't we look into some of the other anomalies that are reported and see what sort of associations pop up, you know, like light anomalies and that sort of thing. So I did that for whatever examples in this book fit those categories. And I went by solar flares and by UFO sightings nearby and by phases of the moon and a couple of other anything else that was weird that stood out. And it was surprising. There were far more correspondences between things that happened during solar flares than there were during the full moon. The full moon didn't seem to have as much effect as the solar flares. And again, it was just a kind of a big beginning start. But if this was done with every incident that comes along that we're able to document where the particulars are known, you know, perhaps we would start learning more.
Is there something that you you identified very early on in your career as an author that you've had to wait some years before you were able to present it in a book?
Well, the first ones came kind of fast and furious because people were just sending stuff to me, and I was trying to include everything. But it was taking me an average of 6 months to write a book. And now when I'm getting a little pickier about I want things to fit particular categories, it takes a little longer to pile up ones, you know, that are just coming to me because I still am receiving these things, you know, 26 years later. But also there are ones that haven't fit into anything. For instance, I started right from the beginning getting the occasional report about some kind of weird canine. And people would say it didn't really look like a dog. It was way bigger than a dog, way bigger than a wolf. It did not walk on its hind legs, but the head looked primitive. The jaws were huge. The head looked too big for the body. You know, it just had this weirdness about it, and they often were chasing cars or seen along roadsides, and I thought, well, these really aren't, you know, man-wolves or wolf-men that we can call them that because they don't have the main characteristic. They don't stand up and run around on their hind legs. So I wasn't knowing what to do with them. And then before Monsters Among Us, after Monsters Among Us and before this one that's coming out, I realized I had a pretty hefty folder full of them that just sort of crept up over the years, and I thought, oh, my gosh, I've got to put these together. And so it's a very big chapter in my next book that's coming out and giving me kind of a headache because I've been collecting some of these so long. The people who reported them have changed their email addresses or contact info, and I'm still trying to get hold of some of them for their signature to sign off on having them in. I can still do it if I paraphrase everything and don't use their names. It's usually okay, but I like to hear from them themselves. So I do have this big stack of observations on these giant dogs, and that's kind of a culmination for me of many years, really.
If you had to go back and look at all of your books, what's the one that you had the most enjoyment in writing and why?
Oh, wow. It's hard to say. I really like Monsters Among Us. That actually, because it's a compendium of the strange sorts of encounters that I also had been sort of filtering out, that I realized was my own bias. And I was able to go, and because some of these people really, to feel right about their stories, I needed to interview them in person several times if I could reach them. And so, you know, I just met some really delightful people, and I was so continually amazed at the associations that were coming out. It was an enjoyable book to write, and I do think it's my favorite of them. My very first book was kind of a joy. It took me 6 years just to research, and that was True Historic Crime, The Poison Widow. I think it's finally out of print right now. But that one, True Historic Crime, was a pleasure because I got to research in history. I was doing genealogy on these people, finding out really fascinating things that happened. I had like 500 or 600 pages of court documents with original letters from between the perpetrators. And this was the story of, the true story happened in the 1920s of a woman in southeastern Wisconsin who didn't live all that far from that Jefferson Institute, by the way, St. Coletta Institute, who she married an older man. She was 17, he was 34. He was a prosperous farmer and school teacher, and they had a lovely family, four children, and they decided to rent some rooms in their house out to university students. And she ended up having an affair with one of these students back in the 1920s. This was horribly, horribly risque behavior at that time. And it turned out that between the two of them, they killed her husband with strychnine and would have gotten away with it, except then she also decided to kill her four children with strychnine. And it just went horribly awry, kind of like almost a Keystone Cops type of thing, and she was discovered. And there were really weird coincidences turning up. For instance, little daughter's neighbor friend had been, her little daughter was asking if the neighbor friend could go along on the ride the night Myrtle planned to kill her children with strychnine put into bonbons.
Oh.
And this little neighbor girl ended up being my next door neighbor in Elkhorn at the time I was writing the book. And I didn't know that. And here I was next to this witness who was there at the time, living right next door. Also, the district attorney that cracked the case turned out to be related to my husband. His last name was Godfrey. He started the Godfrey Law Firm in Elkhorn. So everywhere I looked, there were these weird coincidences happening. And because it was my first book, you know, there's always that kind of unknown, and I just really enjoyed the challenge of it. But yeah, six years of actual research, you know, sending for tracts of and contracts and all that kind of thing. It was a pleasure to write.
Well, I've got to thank you for something. I have never made the connection between the ancient gods, the Egyptian gods, and cryptids. I have never, ever made that connection.
I wish I could take credit, but I wasn't the one who actually, I mean, it's been discussed for a while, even before, you know, the Ancient Alien TV shows, which have made kind of a big thing about it. I think John Keel, the late great researcher, was one of those who talked about it, and there have been others too. You know, I'm sure I could dig up the names in a minute. But sometimes I think they're a little overstretched, but other times they just fit so right on. But it's when you look at the overall picture of how all these civilizations had things that seemed to be part man, part animal. Why? Why would they think that? Where would they get it? You know, especially those who are, look how geographically distant South America is from Egypt, you know, and yet they have a lot of the same things. So that's the thing about it that makes it. If it was only a little one-off, you know, one little temple in Tibet or something had them, it wouldn't seem so startling. But when you realize they all do, and Native Americans, you know, you look at the Hopi Kachinas, they're just everywhere.
Yes, and the Coco Pele and
right.
But I've got to ask this question. Then you're looking back at, let's say, the Mothman. And I'm going to reference directly the movie with, I believe it was Richard Gere, which was a little bit hard to follow until you knew the backstory to it, that whenever this being appeared, it seemed to herald in some type of a disastrous event. Could it be the same thing, that these are simply extra-dimensional beings who are trying to communicate with us, and we're just seeing them oddly, or, as you imply, the way that they want to appear, but they're really here to give us information or prophesy or herald events?
Well, you know, it very well could be, because the man bat in La Crosse, you know, of course, occurred a couple of decades after the original Mothman, but it too heralded, it was 3 days before a drowning that occurred in downtown La Crosse, the nearest town, where there had been drowning after drowning, where university students would just walk down to the river and wade in and drown. There would be no signs of foul play. And one happened just 3 days after that man bat made his appearance. And these went all the way back to the late 1800s. So it could be. I don't know that it happens in every case, or that people are apparent. Maybe there are connections being made that nobody really knows how to recognize or interpret. It's hard to say, but it does seem like there may be some meaning to these things, yeah.
Well, we're up against the clock, but what's next? What's next for Linda? What do you, I mean, my God, this is such an unexplored field. What do you plan to do next?
Well, I've been busy with, there have been a couple of movie makers, one that just recently came out, The Bray Road Beast, by Seth Breedlove. I spent some time with them filming, and they came out with a very, very nice documentary. There's another one that came and visited me here, and I dedicated some time to, called Cryptozoologist, and it's myself and four other, Lauren Coleman and several other cryptozoologists are featured. They just kind of follow us around and see what we do, which much of the time is quite boring to to watch. But so I've been spent, and there's another one right now. I'm involved with filming two others, one in particular that's taking a lot of my time. I don't know. This last book really took a lot out of me, the one that's still coming out, forthcoming yet. And so I don't know if I'm going to do another one like that in this way or not. I'm still thinking about that. But I do have these other projects going. And we'll just have to see what happens when this other book finally comes out, because it's a little different than the other ones have been.
Well, it's such a huge topic. Like Julie said, I don't know where you get the time to research all of this. Now, you've got a website where you list a lot of your works and all of your books. Where can listeners find you, or where can they get your books?
Sure. My books are available, you know, just about any online bookstore. Barnes & Noble carries them. Some of the bigger chain stores do. And if you go to my website, is a blog. It's just lindagodfrey.com. No WWs. Just Linda Godfrey, GODFREY.com. And there you can find stories that aren't published anywhere else, or that are just a little different. Lots of things to read. And then also there's an about page where you can see my book list, as you said, bios, you know, some photos. And I'm in the process of beefing that up a little bit. And I've got a new posting that's going to be coming in the next week too. But if you sign up for that, like it, then you'll get regular notifications when things are coming out, and the news about my new book and that sort of thing will be on there. So, and you can also, there's a form that you can fill out either to report something, or just, you know, if you need to ask me something, it's there. That's my email address too. And so pretty much everything you need. There's even an about the dog man frequently asked questions page that you can go to.
Yeah, I was going to ask, before we close, I was going to ask, do you take referrals, and how many do you get? I mean, everybody has got a Bigfoot story. Everybody has seen the Chupacabra. I've got to throw that in for one specific listener. Everybody has seen something. How do you sort through it, and how many do you get?
Well, you know, here's the thing. a lot of people have seen things, especially ghosts. I mean, so many people, a very high percentage of households report having seen a ghost or know somebody who did. Very few people, though, report them. They don't want to be accused of being crazy. They just feel silly about having seen it. They're in denial, all kinds of reasons. So although there are many, many sightings, there are really not as many reports as there should be. And, you know, I still get, you know, from one or more a week, which if you total up over all the weeks in 26 years is a lot. They're not all equal. You know, some don't contain enough information. Some may just be a question. You know, but there are plenty of really meaty things that, keep on coming. And now it's not just me either. For a long time, during most of the time I was at that newspaper, very few other people were interested in things that looked like wolves walking upright. And they were calling them, well, snouted Bigfoots or something like that. And some people still think that's what they are, and that's fine. But if you look at the anatomy, they're quite different. So I don't agree. But now there's been an explosion in the past 3, 4, 5 years where other people are coming out and studying the dog man openly. And it's being recognized as something different, something, it behaves different. It not only looks different, it behaves differently than the Bigfoot, but it's seen just as, not quite as often as the Bigfoot. I think the Bigfoot sightings are wider spread, but it's definitely seen and reported by people.
Wow. Well, Linda, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today on the House of Mystery.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me, and thanks to all of your listeners.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.